So good afternoon.
Yesterday this is WBUR. We're interrupting here and now to bring you live coverage of Governor Charlie Baker's daily coronavirus briefing from the state. Tests.
There were 1,940 new confirmed cases of COVID-19. That's about a 19% positive test rate, which is consistent with the rate we've seen the past few days and significantly below where it was when we got started. We continue to hold daily calls with our healthcare leaders to closely monitor hospital capacity and hospitalization rates statewide. As of yesterday, 3,803 patients, which was again about 6% of all cases, were hospitalized due to COVID-19. This is the third day in a row that COVID-19-related hospitalizations have slightly decreased. While there are still thousands of people in need of hospital-level care, this number has not gone up, which is a very good sign for a couple of weeks. And I would just say something I constantly say here, which is it's important for people to remember that a big part of why we put so much work and you put so much work into distancing, staying at home, only going out if you actually needed to, was to slow the spread. And it's also why we put so much work into working with our colleagues in the healthcare and hospital community to make sure that we would have the capacity when the surge got here to not just take care of the people who got ill because of COVID-19 during the surge, but that the hospital community and the healthcare system generally would be able to take care of everybody else too. And I'm pleased to say that we have heard from several of our colleagues in the hospital community that people have been coming into the ED. People have been sort of reacquainting themselves in some cases with the healthcare system, and we think that continues to be critically important. And I also want to say that we do know that there have been hundreds of thousands of telehealth visits that have taken place between clinicians and patients since we put that emergency order in place some 6 weeks ago. And that's turned out to be a very effective way for people to engage with their clinicians on a pretty regular basis without necessarily having to put either one in a face-to-face situation. Obviously, each part of Massachusetts is at a slightly different stage with respect to the pandemic. So when we see a statewide drop in patients who are being hospitalized for COVID-19, there are hospitals that have significantly fewer patients and that there are some that have significantly more. But overall, this is a very good sign. Frontline medical workers in many cases have been and continue to work around the clock. And because everybody's been playing their role and doing their part, they have the capacity and the ability to deal with the sickest patients who are dealing with COVID. And we continue to chase down every avenue that's available to us with respect to PPE to ensure the safety of our emergency responders, our frontline healthcare workers, and many of our vulnerable residents. And as of yesterday, we've delivered over 7.3 million pieces of personalized protective equipment, including masks, gowns, gloves, and ventilators. This gear is coming from a variety of places and going to a variety of places, but primarily hospitals, senior facilities, and first responders. As infectious disease specialists continue to learn more about COVID-19, it's clear that this virus is highly contagious and can be spread from person to person without symptoms. And what I mean by that is a significant portion of the people who actually carry the COVID-19 virus never show any symptoms at all, but they are in fact contagious. That means it's possible for a person to infect other close contacts with COVID-19 without knowing that they are infected themselves. We'll continue to do everything we can to expand testing to detect high infection rates, hotspots, and particular communities where we believe we need to be doing more testing. And we continue to arm our facilities with the supplies that they need to test larger and larger populations. And as we've said many times, while we work with the healthcare community to push back on the virus, everyone else has a role to play that's equally important. And as part of that effort, we've already advised that everyone should use face masks or face coverings in public spaces when they are unable to practice social distancing. As we continue to think about the future and a return to a new normal, covering our faces when we cannot practice social distancing is an easy, critically important, and essential step that everyone can and should take to stop or slow the spread. Earlier today, I signed an executive order requiring residents to use a face covering in public places when they cannot socially distance from others. This order does not apply to children under the age of 2 or to people who are unable to wear a face mask or a face covering due to medical conditions or other DPH-issued exemptions. I've also directed the Department of Public Health to issue additional guidance regarding children between the ages of 2 and 5 years old for parents and for guardians. This requirement applies to all workers and customers of businesses and other organizations that are open to the public. The public's required to wear a face covering at all times in grocery stores, retail stores, or on public transportation. The order goes into effect on May 6th. There are several ways you can make your own face covering using items in your wardrobe. It could be made from a bandana, a t-shirt, or other breathable fabrics. Disposable masks are also an option. We strongly discourage residents from using medical-grade masks, and those should be prioritized for healthcare workers and first responders. We've made many requests over the course of the past 6 weeks of this great state, including staying at home, avoiding gatherings, and socially distancing. Our mobility data shows that people have cooperated in many ways to a greater extent than people in practically any other state, if you believe some of the reports that are out there. And it's making a big difference as we fight this highly contagious disease. This order builds on that same idea that everyone doing a small thing all the time can go a long way to improving everyone else's ability to avoid the virus. When folks are out in public places where they cannot social distance, like in stores and on public transportation, everyone needs to wear a face covering for your own protection. Several businesses have already issued similar policies, and so have several municipalities. We view this as common sense and an important way on a statewide basis to establish for the long term a set of standards for what we would call the new normal. I also want to provide a quick update on the expansion of our community health center testing across the Commonwealth. On April 22nd, we announced a partnership with Quest Diagnostics and the Mass League of Community Health Centers to increase testing initially at 12 community health centers. This number will grow. These facilities are deeply rooted in their communities and are committed to facilitating access to care and eliminating health disparities. Quest Diagnostics agreed to ship 1,700 tests per day to centers in Quincy, Brockton, Lowell, Fall River, New Bedford, Provincetown, and multiple sites in Boston. The Boston locations are the Dot House Health Center, East Boston Community Health Center, Codman Square Health Center, and Whittier Street Health Center. Today, we're pleased to announce that Quest and the League are expanding to more facilities. In total, Quest is now sending test kits to 18 community health centers. The new facilities that will either start or expand testing include the Lynn Community Health Center, Holyoke Health Center, North Shore Community Health Center, South Boston Community Health Center, the Community Health Center of Franklin County. This partnership is off to a great start. In the first several days, Quest sent out nearly 12,000 test kits, and more are being shipped each day. In a few minutes, it'll be my pleasure to welcome Sue Joss from Brockton Neighborhood Health Center to the podium. Sue's program was one of the original community health centers to join this testing expansion. She's here today to provide an update on how this has impacted her community in the fight against COVID-19. Sue and her team have done an incredible job working with others, and especially with the homeless population in Brockton, and their participation in the contact tracing program has been equally important, including hiring multilingual workers to support outreach among their residents. I want to thank you, Sue, for your hard work and the imagination and creativity of your team, and we're grateful to have you as part of our team in this fight. In closing, I want to once again express our sincere gratitude to the hundreds of people from across Massachusetts that have personally reached out to me, to the Lieutenant Governor, and to members of our administration with offers to help and with words of encouragement. We're incredibly grateful for that support and your desire to raise your hand in order to make a difference in the lives of people here in our Commonwealth has not gone unnoticed. I also want to say thank you to the members of my cabinet, as well as to the members of our staff and the governor's office for the amazing amount of work that they've done day after day after day with no days off over the course of the past 2 months. Those efforts have been tireless and represent the very best of public service. And finally, I want to express our thanks to the members of the media who are assembled here and to those in the newsrooms across the state for showing up every single day to cover this story. It's vital that the public have access to accurate and unbiased information about the actions that we're taking to combat this terrible virus, how people can go about protecting themselves, what's going on in their own communities, and the significant toll that this virus is taking on our people, our economy, and our country. This is a critically important public service that people need, and especially need in a time like this, and can rely on. And I want to thank you all for that. With that, I'm going to turn the podium over to Sue.
You're listening to WBUR's live coverage of Governor Charlie Baker's daily coronavirus briefing, Governor, from the State House.
Thank you, Lieutenant Governor and Secretary Sutters. I just want to say you all and your command center have done an awesome job leading us through this crisis, so can't express our appreciation enough. I'm Sue Joss. I am the CEO of Brockton Neighborhood Health Center. I've been there for 26 years. I'm also the chair of the board of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers. Our health center serves 35,000 mostly low-income and very diverse patients with large populations from Cape Verde, Haiti, and Brazil. I was thinking back 6 weeks to when we first realized that the surge was upon us. It was a Saturday. We had seen a couple of cases and had started some planning and we're really thinking about ramping it up over the next couple weeks. But our chief medical officer was working that Saturday, and he called me and he said, it started, it's here, the surge is here, the lines are out the door. So I was walking my dogs deep in the woods of Borderland State Park and quickly rushed back home and called our entire team to work for the entire weekend. We immediately shut down our dental and eye services departments, except for emergencies, because we couldn't safely care for those patients, and started scrubbing our schedules to see how many patients we could see by televisits, which we had never done before, and we had televisits up and running within days. The testing rates in Brockton, we had initially a really hard time getting tests, and we were testing only the symptomatic patients, and the positive rates were just incredible. So we have, as of today, as of this morning, 837 of our health center patients have tested positive out of 2,341 total tested. If you do the math, that's 36% positive, which is twice the statewide average. Part of that is because we didn't have the access to testing that we needed earlier on, so we were only testing the patients that we thought were the sickest. We launched a collaboration with the mayor of Brockton. Bob Sullivan had only been the mayor for 2 months when this landed on us and on him, and he has stepped up and been the leader that we really needed in this crisis on a municipal level. He pulled the hospitals together and then quickly added in the Board of Health and the homeless shelter and emergency management in our town when it became clear that we were becoming one of the hot spots of Massachusetts very quickly. Our first outbreak that we noticed, that we identified, was at the homeless shelter. We decided to test all of them and came out with 39 positives out of 150-ish tested. And then just recently have done a retesting and added 8 or 9 more positives to that group. So when we heard that the governor was expanding the testing initiative to 12 community health centers, we were just beyond thrilled to know that we were among them, because we knew that with a 36% positive rate, we needed to be doing a lot more testing. So the day that Governor Baker issued that order, we immediately started testing even more patients. And we have a tent on our site in addition to our urgent care department that is now all COVID. And even that, we thought, wasn't going to be enough. So being one of the first 12 health centers allowed us to work with our collaborators, the mayor and Brockton Hospital, Signature Healthcare, and the Board of Health and Emergency Management to set up a community-wide testing site on the grounds of Brockton High School. I'm thrilled to let you know that that site opened today. We had just a few patients go through today just as a dry run to make sure that we had all the kinks worked out, and that site will open in earnest on Monday, May 4th, this coming Monday. We'll have two lanes. This is all by pre-registration because we do need to screen patients first. But none of this could have happened if the governor hadn't put us as a priority health center to start this testing. So we are hoping to start on that site at about 150 tests a day and quickly get up to about 400 a day and maybe beyond that if the capacity is needed. So want to thank the governor and your team for allowing us to take care of our community in the way that we think is so important. Also wanted to briefly mention the contact testing program, as we are one of the health centers participating in that. Even though we're crazy busy at the health center, there are some staff that didn't have enough work in their current roles, referrals, coordinators, community health workers, and all multilingual, all rooted in the community. So they were easy, obvious choices to move into contact tracing, and we have 13 staff in the process of joining the state's contact tracing team, so we're thrilled with that as well. I want to finish my messages with just a plea to community health center patients who don't have COVID. We are still open for business. We want to see you. We have a separate part of the building for patients who are not coming in for COVID-related symptoms, and we're doing hundreds of telehealth medicine visits per day. So we, on behalf of all of the community health centers, want to let you know that we're still here and we still want to do business with you. Also wanted to give a shout out to the State Command Center. Leslie Darcy and Elizabeth Larson in particular have been crucial to our expansion and to identifying the issues with the homeless population and quickly finding hotels to move them into where they could be safe and avoid infecting others. And finally, I'd like to thank again the administration. The funding that you put out very quickly to community health centers has allowed us to do what we're doing and saved us from financial disaster that would have happened based on the revenue we've lost with the loss of patients in other non-COVID services. So thank you for all you're doing, and glad to be part of this initiative.
So first of all, we've watched and discovered that people, for the most part, have acted on the advisory the same way that people acted on the advisory we put out on the stay-at-home issue about a month ago. But I think we all believe that as part of the strategy around anything associated with reopening, people are going to need a mask or a face covering if they're going to be close to people. You can't always stay 6 feet away, and even if you can stay 6 feet away, especially if you're inside, you probably ought to have a face covering on. And there's two reasons for that. One is obviously to protect you from others, but just as important is to protect others from you. As I said previously in my remarks, the fact that such a significant portion, still a minority part of the portion of the population, but such a significant part of the population that tests positive for COVID-19 will never show symptoms means that it's critically important that we all accept the fact that if everybody's wearing a mask, it will dramatically reduce the opportunity and the possibility of spread.
Is the CDC came up with recommendations on April 3rd? Why did it take until now to come up with
Well, as I said, we put the advisory out shortly after that, I think within a day or two. And what we're doing today is basically taking that advisory, turning it into an order, providing a little more specificity, giving cities and towns some tools that they can use to both monitor and enforce it, and recognize and understand that this is going to be, for all intents and purposes, a big part of the way we operate as part of the reopening.
Will you consider fines like certain communities?
You're listening to WBUR's live coverage of Governor Charlie Baker's daily coronavirus briefing at the State House.
Statewide, because it's going to be, if somebody doesn't wear a face covering into a supermarket, the call typically goes to either the local Board of Health, the city manager's office, the Board of Selectmen, the mayor's office, the local police department. That's where people typically go. And honestly, that's where I would expect them to go, which is why we left in the executive order the ability for cities and towns to establish enforcement mechanisms if they believe they need to.
Governor, you must be concerned about the weather coming in, nice weather. I know you closed the parking lots at some of the beaches, but we do expect a lot of people to go to the beach. We've seen Southern California. Would this apply to people going to those types of places where there's a lot of people together?
You know, I think this is going to be, there's going to be some judgment in this. There are plenty of places you can go right now for a walk where you will very much be for yourself, by yourself. There are also many places you can go for a walk where you won't be, where you know before you get there you're going to be surrounded by a lot of other people, and in those situations people should have a face covering. And I think most people should carry it with them and anticipate that they will. I mean, when my wife and I go for a walk in Swampscott, we take face coverings with us. I usually wear it. She carries it. But if we get anywhere near anybody else, we put it on.
Governor, can you tell us about the mechanisms for enforcement? Is it fines like we're seeing in some communities, or can you expand on what those mechanisms are?
Well, we gave people the ability to issue a fine if they wish to, or to issue a warning. It's a civil infraction. The other thing I would say is that we've talked to Mayor Driscoll and to some of the other local officials who've put a more aggressive policy in place. And what they've said to us is they've issued warnings, they haven't had to issue fines, and that the big message they had is that signage and a statewide standard will help dramatically with making this what we would call sort of the standard operating procedure for people when they're going to be out, and especially when they're going to be inside premises where they don't have the ability to distance, or outside in circumstances where they don't. So I said, I think at the first, if it wasn't the first COVID-19 press conference we had, it was the first or the second one, that I completely understood the sense of purpose that would be lost by so many that comes with work before you even get to the issues associated with the economic calamity. But given the contagious nature and the insidious nature and the danger associated with coronavirus and COVID-19, we felt the only way to stop the spread, to reduce the size and significance of the surge, and to make sure that our healthcare system would be able to work its way through it, would be to establish physical distancing, stay-at-home orders, and essential business rules, recognizing that there are trade-offs, big ones, associated with doing that. Since that time, the guidance that's come out from basically every other country, including this one, has been that until you actually see a downward trend in some of the key indices associated with the presence of COVID-19, it would be a mistake to reopen your economy. And this isn't just me talking. This is the president's task force. This is almost every major leader of every major country that's dealing with this issue right now. They all say the same thing, which is until you see some evidence that the fire is at least down by virtue of either your testing data or your hospitalization data, your ICU use, until you start to see some measure that implies that the distancing and all this other really hard and difficult stuff that people have been up to is working, you shouldn't reopen. And that when you do reopen, you should be very careful about the way you reopen. You should plan accordingly, which is what the Lieutenant Governor and Secretary Keneally and their group are doing. And you should make sure that whatever way you phase in that reopening, you do it in a way that ensures you have some ability to both survey what's going on and that you have a tracing program in place so that you can contain the virus by making sure you know who has it, who they were in contact with, and what you're doing to isolate people. And I get the fact that all of this comes with tremendous amounts of dislocation, dismay, and economic hardship. It's why we work so hard to be one of the nation's leaders with respect to standing up and processing both the traditional unemployment program and the new one, because we knew people needed resources. But I think in many ways, the guidance on this one is really clear. And until we see that plateau start to move in the right direction, and it has moved a little bit in the right direction, we could, by reopening, we could actually create another fire and be dealing with this thing all over again, you know, at some point shortly down the road. When we reopen, we want to do it based on the right data, at the right time, with the right mechanisms in place to monitor this, so we only have to do this once. Because the calamity and economic hardship associated with it is absolutely not something any of us wants to have to put up with again.
Governor, hospitalizations over the last 3 days or so drops by less than 100. What kind of number are you looking for, hoping for, a daily or maybe over 3 or 4 days? Are we talking 500? What would be a good number to drop?
I think it's actually less about how many per day and more about over some period of time. I mean, most of the data that's out there talks about a sustained demonstration of a change in the trajectory. And that's clearly been the measure that's been used in most other states and actually most other countries.
Can you talk to us about the progress with regard to contact tracing? I know you had mentioned yesterday 5,000 people have been reached. Any idea how many cases you've actually been able to review?
We'll be back here probably next week to talk a little more detail around contact tracing, and I'd rather wait until then so we can give you kind of a full-blown update on where all of it is.
That number you gave yesterday about 2 contacts per infected person?
Yeah.
Just feels totally wrong. Just doesn't seem possible. Do you have any explanation of that? Because you started out, the estimate was 10, and then it dropped.
No, I know. I think I'm going to let the experts speak to that when they come in next week, but they said they were surprised when they started reaching out to people and talking to them about close contacts that most people did not have anywhere near as many close contacts in the previous 48 to 72 hours as they thought they would.
Governor, you've asked people to.
I'm the message deliverer here, okay, on this one. So we'll have people in next week who can speak to it directly, who are directly involved.
Governor, on contact tracing, you've asked people to answer the phone if caller ID
can pass. That's another thing that we will talk about when we see you guys next week, but it's something we're absolutely aware of.
Governor, this morning you tweeted a photo of ventilators that were delivered to the state from New Jersey. Can you speak a little bit about that and what our ventilator supply looks like right now?
When we originally headed down the road of dealing with the surge, we estimated that we needed roughly 1,000 ventilators. We got 400 through the stockpile. We got 400 from New York, we got 50 from manufacturers, and 9 that were donated. Getting 50 more from the state of New Jersey, I would describe as, first of all, a generous act on their part and an insurance policy for us.
Governor, about face masks, do you think people should be able to use to service if they're not wearing them?
One of the things we said in our order was that we were authorizing business owners, local businesses, to be able to make a decision if somebody was in their facility, their store, or whatever, without wearing a face covering or a face mask. And I think our view is that should be up to the local store owner operator, but our point of view was it should be up to them and they should be able to make the decision they believe is the appropriate one. I'll tell you, I will be really surprised if people don't head down the road on this one in a pretty big way. I mean, when all the feedback that the Lieutenant Governor and the Secretary are getting from the people they talk to on the employer side every single day is that this is going to be basically a way of life, okay? There's no ifs, no ands, no buts, no doubts, okay? And I certainly think that for the most part, if you can't distance, inside or outside, you're going to be expected to wear a face covering or a mask. And I think in many cases, the thing that's driving people in this direction is the combination of not just protecting yourself, but also protecting others, given the high number of people who get this this virus who never show symptoms. I mean, that's what makes it in many respects so insidious in the first place. And I think most of us get the fact that if we potentially could have this thing and could give it to a whole bunch of other people who we care about, and if we wore a face mask and or a face covering and they wore a face covering or face mask, we'd reduce the likelihood of that happening from here to here, most people are going to do it.
So are you disappointed that you have to do this executive order? You think it's common sense? I mean, why have to order people?
Oh, it's a big change, I think, for many people, but I'm hoping we get to the point where, as we move down the road here, I'm hoping we get to the point where it becomes the norm, because it should be.
Should they be wearing masks?
I guess it depends a little bit on the distancing question. If you look at, and again, I'm just talking about, this is relatively anecdotal, but, you know, I see people jog by my house when I'm up at 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning. They're all by themselves. There's nobody out. The likelihood they're going to pass, run into, or come anywhere near anybody is pretty slim. But if you were to ask me that same question at 5:30 in the afternoon or 6 o'clock, when there's a lot of people out, I think that person should wear a face covering, yeah, because they are going to end up spending a fair amount of time during the course of that run well within 6 feet of a whole lot of other people. Yeah, I mean, we've got, I won't get these numbers exactly right, but basically 70% plus or minus of the people who are applying are getting their money in pretty short order on the traditional program. It's a higher percentage on the PUA program. But we added people not just to the call center side, but also to the side to run through some of the issues associated with disputes. But as is the case with the traditional program, the numbers there are bigger, so people are working through more cases than they used to work through, but there are a lot more people working those cases. But there's always a certain, I mean, that is a standard operating procedure. It's always there in the UI program, always has been, always will be, and it's not an inappropriate thing. There's supposed to be a mechanism in place for an employer-employee dispute to be heard and to be decided on. And I'm not aware that the process associated with that is taking any longer. It's just not a process that anybody's probably focused on very much when we had a small number of people going through that system as opposed to an enormous number of people going through it.
Can I ask you a quick question?
Yeah.
So would you mind stepping the podium for a quick question? I'm interested in dealing with the homeless population. Obviously, I'm sure there's a lot of struggle with getting this message through. We all see homeless people congregating and they're not practicing social distancing. They don't have masks on. How can we get through them, if at all?
In Brockton, that's been a big issue. The homeless shelter, Mainspring House, before the outbreak was housing people in triple bunks with mattresses on the floor, so they had no opportunity to social distance. And the folks at Father Bill's in Mainspring now have tents. MEMA has supplied tents so that they can social distance from each other. They have masks. We have a nurse practitioner full-time on site, and she is hounding at them all of the time to wear masks. We have them available for them. It is a struggle. We still see the homeless guests out down the street without masks on. So,
hey, Sue, you want to talk a little bit about what we're doing together around isolation for people who test positive?
I would love to. Thank you. So one of the things that the command center has helped us with is when we first identified the large number of homeless people who tested positive, the command center was just setting up some of the hotels. So we were really early in this. So they were able to transfer 35 or so positive COVID people out of the shelter and up to the hotels. Some of them have now recovered and come back. In addition, we just heard as of yesterday that people who are displaced from their apartments, and we're seeing a lot of that at the health center, that live 10, 12 people in an apartment, so they're temporarily homeless because of COVID, their roommates don't want them there, that we are now able to send them to those hotels as well to separate them.
Thanks, everybody. I'll tell you, have a nice weekend. You're probably going to see you tomorrow.
Governor, can I ask one question, sir? Just one question. It's about the golf industry. It's a $2.7 billion industry and 25,000 jobs, 400 golf courses. They're facing a serious impact over the last month. And they feel that you don't feel their pain, especially this time of year. So the question is, why is it necessary to extend their ban two more weeks when they were anticipating opening their operations on May 4th? And I just preface that. 44 other states are open for golf starting on Monday, May 5th. Sorry, one more part of that question is, what can they do to expedite the opening before May 18th?
So first of all, I said in my remarks, and I say it almost every day in my remarks, that we get the fact that these essential, non-essential business decisions, the social distancing, the lack of gatherings, and the shutdowns are incredibly painful, okay? And we've never, ever suggested or implied that the decisions that we've made here to protect public health didn't come with consequences. They do. They did. They have. But the consequences of not making those decisions, of not doing those things, from our point of view, based on what we saw in other countries leading up to the virus landing here in Massachusetts, we viewed and believed would have been far worse. And I continue to believe that. One of the things the president did that I support was he said states probably ought to make a lot of their own decisions with respect to how they reopen, how they manage this thing on the ground, because many states are in different places and have been all the way through this. I've had a slightly different point of view about the federal government's role in testing and treatment and PPE and a whole bunch of other things like that. But on giving states the ability based on what's going on in their state to make decisions about how they handle this, that's not a decision I disagree with. I actually support it. And Massachusetts has been far harder hit by this virus than almost every other state on a per capita basis, except maybe New York and possibly New Jersey. And so when I look at those other states, I see many other states that are in a very different place than we are with respect to almost every issue associated with how you manage or monitor the data associated with the nature and the power and the strength of the infection. The other thing I would say is we're not a warm weather state. It's been winter for the most part. I get the fact that there are golfers who like to golf in the winter. But if you were to say to me, do I think that golfing in the winter would be considered an essential thing to be doing at a point in time when we were closing down thousands and thousands and thousands of other non-essential businesses in Massachusetts? My answer to that would be no.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Will you be willing to participate in a Zoom conference call with just two golf pros and two golf course owners? Take 20 minutes, you, the Lieutenant Governor,
I'm actually pretty sure that at some point the golf people are coming to talk to the reopening advisory board, which is why we put the reopening advisory board together.
Thanks very much.
They are going to talk to the reopening advisory board. That's why we put it together. And I tell you all, have a nice weekend, but I'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to WBUR's live coverage of Governor Charlie Baker's daily coronavirus briefing from the State House. I'm Tiziana Deering, and WBUR's Anthony Brooks has also been listening and joins us now. Hi there, Anthony.
Hey, Tiziana.
So, Anthony, clearly one big announcement today. You want to tell us about it?
Yeah, absolutely. Word about this leaked out earlier, but the governor has issued an order requiring everyone in Massachusetts to wear a face mask in public, including in businesses, outdoors, whether they're on public transportation, all of that if they're unable to socially distance from other people. And we understand that this order is going to go into effect next week, Wednesday, I believe, and it'll be up to local communities to issue fines or warnings and so on and so forth. But clearly, Tiziana, another step toward the new normal in this sense, because Baker talked about this as being an essential part of what's going to be required to open the state when that day finally comes, when businesses can be reopened and so on and so forth. People are going to have to wear face masks beginning next week, and you get the sense for a long time to come.
Yeah, he actually said at one point during the Q&A about it, quote, "This is going to be basically a way of life. No ifs, no buts, and no doubts," end quote, which really is more than just establishing an order for now. This is really signaling what the new normal is going to look like.
Yeah, it really is. And it gets down to, as he described, that the sort of insidious and highly dangerous nature of this particular infection, because the fact that he keeps pounding home and that a lot of healthcare experts keep pounding home is that so many people can be infected, a very high number of people can be infected and can be passing it on to other people without even realizing that they're infected. They can be asymptomatic. So the only way, or one of the essential ways, things that they can do to protect other people is to wear a face mask. It protects you and it protects the people around you, especially if you're one of those asymptomatic carriers. So the best solution, according to the governor and a lot of folks, is to wear a face mask. And as you suggested, it's going to be part of the new normal for a long, long time to come, it sounds like.
And to be really clear, while the governor suggested that if you're outdoors and you can still socially distance, you might have a mask with you but not be wearing it. But I think my take from listening to him was that in terms of being inside retail spaces, grocery stores, basically anywhere indoors, out in public, you're going to be wearing a mask. You're going to be required to. Was that your understanding as well?
Yeah, that was my understanding. And the governor left it up to local communities. And I think in a way he also signaled that this is about common sense. I mean, he talked about, for example, in his own hometown of Swampscott, if he looks out the window and he sees someone jogging by at 5 in the morning, they're alone. They're in a town with no one around them. They're not wearing a face mask. Not so much a problem. But a much different situation at 5 in the afternoon when there are lots of people out there running and walking and biking and whatever it is, then wearing a face mask makes a whole lot of sense. But I guess to sort of, make a kind of unified message of principle, it's like you've got to wear a face mask all the time if you're out in public and you can't socially distance from someone. So there we have it. It's interesting to note, though, Tiziana, how a lot of towns have already gotten to this point. I mean, we reported last week, for example, the town of Somerville, the city of Somerville, $300 fine if you're not wearing a Facebook. I was looking at the Boston Globe, a review of some 60 towns and cities across the state that have issued orders requiring masks as of today. Some of them in a position of doing fines as well for people who aren't complying. So in a way, the governor is catching up with what is already out there in terms of what cities and towns are doing.
Anthony, there was another dimension. We've talked about this so many times before, often the most revealing part of the press conference is in the Q&A with the governor. And there was another dimension that struck us both because he answered some unemployment questions, but he talked about employment in the Commonwealth differently than in the sort of tactical way he usually does. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about, he was sort of talking about the important nature of work and the kind of sense of identity. I mean, he sort of made glancing reference to this, the sort of important sense it gives us of who we are and so forth. But, the other side of that is that given the insidious nature, the dangerous nature of this, he really is committed to this idea that the only way to stop the spread and make sure that the healthcare system wouldn't be overwhelmed was, to establish the stay-at-home orders, closing of non-essential businesses, understanding full well that this brings big trade-offs in terms of, obviously, the economy and people's own sense of self-worth and how they define themselves about their work. So these are dramatic times, to say the least, Tiziana. And
yeah.
These big questions keep coming up on a daily basis that really make us revisit how we live and how we're going to be living for weeks and months to come.
You know, there's been a number of questions that have been raised over the last couple of days, Anthony, about the makeup of this 17-member advisory board, which has some municipal representatives on it, people from state government, many people from industry. I've seen in social media and heard in various spaces increasing concern that the everyday person or the community organization or the house of worship is not represented in that group. Is that going to be a problem, do you think, for the Commonwealth? Or do we get signals from the governor that he's going to ensure that all those kinds of voices are heard by this 17-member advisory board?
So I have no way of knowing, obviously, one way or the other. But the sense I get from the Baker administration, from Governor Baker in particular, is he has shown a remarkable adherence to sort of scientific and medical principles. At the same time, he's shown a willingness, as is necessary in a crisis like this, to adapt. I mean, just think about the face mask question. It's interesting. When this pandemic started and when we were first dealing with the crisis, the sort of idea about face masks was don't wear them. It doesn't make sense. You know, only medical workers should wear face masks and they're not going to protect you anyway. And look how far we've come on that particular question. So I think that idea is one that is going to be sort of consistently seen through all of this. And I wouldn't be surprised if that advisory board begins to include other people and other voices. I mean, it's going to have to because things that we're learning about this crisis and all its dimensions sort of on an hourly basis, it seems like. And I get the sense that this governor understands that and is willing to adapt to that.
Anthony, right at the very end, there was an interesting moment. You and I both know that there's no love lost between the governor and the president, but he was asked a question about the president's choice to really defer reopening decisions to various states. And I thought the governor's response was interesting there.
Yeah, I mean, he said he basically agrees with the idea that states need to have the authority to do this. What he didn't say, I mean, he could have been a little more forceful if he wanted to take President Trump on directly and sort of say, you know, the president never had the authority under the Constitution to begin with. I mean, that's Governor Cuomo made that point in a very pointed and repeated way about the president. But yeah, Baker continues to sort of say, look, I have issues on a lot of stuff with the president and the federal government, whether it's, you know, his search for PPEs or ventilators or testing and that sort of stuff. But when it comes to basic lines of authority and the idea where President Trump landed finally in saying this is up to the governors, Governor Baker was saying, yeah, this is up to the governors. And I agree with the president on that. But I'm not sure he would have agreed with what the president was saying initially about his ultimate authority, as the president claimed.
Anthony, in our last 30 seconds, this was a week where we saw a more human side of the governor a number of times. Do you have any quick reflections on that before we go?
Well, I just think I come back to this idea that Charlie Baker is a numbers guy, a data guy, he's a technocrat, but we've seen a lot of sort of human dimension. And I just come back to this idea that this requires flexibility, this crisis. And I think he's demonstrating that in ways that are admirable.
Well, that's WBUR's Anthony Brooks. I appreciate you joining us today and helping our listeners get the rundown on Governor Charlie Baker's coronavirus briefing. Thanks a lot.
Always a pleasure, Tiziana.